There can be bad language and adult concepts in this program. So please watch out for little ears if you've got your podcast playing and pop on some headphones. That way no one can get offended but you. Rights for Women would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which this podcast is recorded throughout Australia. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded and pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we celebrate women writers, support women's rights and talk all things women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author. I'm founder of Listen Up Podcasting, where we make podcasts for a positive world. Check me out at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or find me on Facebook.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of 5 novels, 4 traditionally published and 1 indie release. I'm a writing teacher and a podcaster. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is available now at all online retailers and at pamelacook.com.au.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe wherever you get your pods.
Hi, Pam here, and today on Rights for Women, I'd like to welcome Jacqueline Kent to the Convo Couch. Jacqueline is an award-winning biographer and who originally trained as a journalist and broadcaster. She's been a book reviewer and editor and has written fiction for young adults. Jacqueline's biography, A Certain Style, Beatrice Davis, A Literary Life, won the 2002 National Biography Award and the Nita B. Kibble Award, as did her biography of Hepzibah Menuhin. She's the author of the only full biography of Julia Gillard and published her own memoir, Beyond Words, A Year with Kenneth Cook, to great acclaim in 2019. Jacqueline's most recent work is a biography of Vida Goldstein, titled Vida, A Woman for Our Time. It's my great pleasure to welcome Jacqueline to the Convo Couch today.
Hello, Pamela.
I'm really excited to chat to you today about this fascinating biography of Vida Goldstein. And before we do that, though, I'd wondering if you could take us back a little and just give us a bit of a rundown on your career as a writer.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm one of these people that always wanted to be a writer. I think it's about the only thing that I showed any great aptitude for. Well, no, I was the kid who wrote a novel at 9, you know, that kind of
thing. Okay, yep. Yeah.
And of course, you know, that always happens. You sort of think, nah, I can't do it, you know, I've got to earn a living, all the rest of it, so on and so forth. So I started off as a journalist on a TV magazine, which was, let's put it this way, fairly sobering as a way to start.
Right, yeah.
Then I went over to London for a few years and mucked around. I mean, this is just completely off the cuff. It's when you could, you know.
Yeah.
I just went there and thought, oh, I'll do this. That'll be fun. Without thinking of anything consequences or anything useful, like trying to craft a career or anything of that sort.
Right, yeah.
I kind of went over there and bummed around for a bit and then came back to Australia and thought, oh, well, I better get a bit serious about this. And very fortunately, there was a job as in a book publishing company, and I knew how to proofread from my experience as a journalist. So I talked my way into that. I'd done a bit of work in the UK, not very much, but I had worked for a publisher there, so I parlayed that madly into a job.
Yeah.
So I did that for a while. And after a bit, I went freelance and started to write books as well, and I started writing social history. My first book was about Australian radio, and then I did some young adult fiction, which I hugely enjoyed, actually. I started, you know, tracking teenagers and stuff. That was fun. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And then I kind of turned from about 2000, I turned to fairly straight biography, and I did a biography of a book editor, in fact, Beatrice Davis, who was the book editor at Angus and Robertson's when Angus and Robertson was a name to conjure with in the 30s, 40s and 50s and 60s. And that was good because I knew her job because I'd done it.
Right, yeah.
Up to her level, but I had done that job. So that was fine. So that was the first one. Then I did a biography of Hepzibah Menuhin, sister of the more famous Yehudi Menuhin, who lived in for a while. She's really interesting. She decided, she was a pianist. What made got me into that was that the three Menuhin children were all prodigies, and I come from a family where precocity is hugely overvalued. So
I love that.
To look at that. And that was fun. And then the next big one, I guess, was Julia Gillard, which was the only biography I've written of someone who's still around. And it's good and it's bad doing it that way because, I mean, they're around and you can, you know, you can actually talk to them and talk to people who are still extant instead of having to sift through libraries and stuff.
Mm.
The bad thing is, of course, that if they're still around and there's, you know, there are many little axes grinding away. So you really
can imagine.
And that's hard. That's actually quite hard. So, and now this one. So, this is my fourth, main biography, the one of Vida. And I think if you've got to look at what they have in common, I guess it's looking at women who are incredibly interesting and who didn't really properly get a fair go because of misogyny, because of when they were alive, because of what happened to them, because of their own work. And I think Vida definitely comes into that category.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I want to talk to you a little bit later about the parallels that you draw in the biography of Vida with Julia Gillard, because, and obviously having written her biography, you're well, you know, versed to be able to do that. But what do you think is it that draws you to writing biography, and particularly biographies of women?
Women. I mean, I suppose it's fairly obvious that, you know, being a woman oneself, you feel that you've got a bit more understanding of the pressures and so forth that we all have to, you know, cope with. That's the first thing. The second thing is it's the fact that biography, what I like about biography is you don't have to worry about the plot.
True.
Yeah. I mean, look, everyone's got the same story, right?
Yeah.
Birth to death. Yeah. And it's really interesting. I think what happens often with that is it's often easier to write something if you're constrained by it. I could go and write sort of science fiction if I were attracted to it, you know, but it's too wide. The parameters are too wide. I like something that's got its own limits and its own way of doing things. And the thing about biography too, now especially, is how interesting it is as a form. It's not just cradle to grave anymore. You know, people start at the beginning. There's one book called Stuart, A Life Backwards, which is about a homeless person starting and having a happy beginning, not a happy
ending. Okay. Yeah, interesting.
So there are different ways and people are experimenting with, which is what they always do. It's like Baroque music. You have the rules. You have the things that I all have in common. And within those parameters, you can do a great deal. So I think that's one of the things that attracts me too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think biography's come a long way, hasn't it? I mean, I'm not a huge biography reader, but I know, you know, back at university and studying a bit of history and reading some biographies then, they're a lot drier than they are now. You know, I think there's a lot more room now, isn't there, for sort of more a personal interpretation of the person's life and drawing those parallels that you do.
I think for the last 30 years or so, biography is sort of going through a golden age because, you know, excuse me, people are always, I think people are just generally interested in other people's lives, especially if they like them. And
yeah.
Well, I am. I like knowing, you know, what did you think about that and how do you feel about that? That's why writing biographies of living people is a bit harder because they're not going to tell you.
Yeah, true. So what actually what drew you to actually write about Vida?
It goes back a very long way, actually, because I had a friend when I was in my 20s and she died last year. The book's dedicated to her, Diane. But she had written for Sydney University. She wrote her honours history thesis on Australian suffragettes. And I thought, oh, I didn't know we had any. I mean, I knew that Australian women got the vote by Act of Parliament, didn't have to smash windows or be imprisoned or anything like that to achieve that. And I thought this sort of showed our innate superiority. But this was, in fact, it was, so Diane actually put me onto a whole swathe of fascinating women, of whom Vida was the predominant one. Mm. And, in fact, she and I wrote a radio feature for ABC Radio National about Vida. And, of course, could I find it when I was doing the research for this? No, I couldn't, but still.
Oh, was really?
Yeah, yeah. So I've always known her name since then. Mm. And then about 3 years ago I was thinking, you know, because I really got interested in women and politics and why women's struggles for politics are so much harder in particular ways than men's, and why, in fact, women got the vote very early in 1903 that were able to stand for Parliament, and they didn't get into Parliament for 40 years.
Yeah, that was, I found that really fascinating in the book.
It's not, you know, a friend of mine pointed out the other day that it was the same with women in medicine. Women, she lives in America, and women actually got the right to be doctors early in Australia, earlier than they did in the US, but they have not achieved the heights of specialisation or, you know, academic administration excellence that men have done. It's a similar story. It's a similar story. And when you look at it, there've got to be reasons for this, and they've got to lie somewhere in the culture. And they're not about women's innate ability, nothing like that. No.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, you mentioned in the introduction, you know, that Vida is, she's sort of mentioned around the place in, you know, histories of women in Australia and things, but considering the work that she did and how hard she, you know, really strove to get that vote for women, there's not really that much known about her. You know, like, I think I vaguely knew her name, but I really didn't know what she'd done until I read the biography. And this is the question that you pose in your introduction. You sort of set out to find out why that was.
Yes.
So that was probably a great impetus for you in sort of directing your research and everything for the book, was it?
It was, actually. I thought she'd been embalmed as an example of something. And I'm always interested in people who reach that kind of understand, that kind of knowledge in people's. Oh, Vida Goldstein. Oh, yeah, she was the first person who put her hand up to be in federal parliament. Yeah. But a lot goes behind that. And I just thought, because that's all she's known for. I mean, she's the answer to a pub trivia quiz question, if you like. Who was the first woman who, you know. And so I thought, no. And I was really amazed and delighted, really pleased about all the work that she had done and all the pies that she had her, you know, put her fingers into, if you like. It was, you know, she went really all the way from international politics to, you know, the women and children in Victoria. I mean, she really, you know, really did an enormous amount of work.
Yeah, yeah, she definitely did. And her, you know, growing up, so she grew up in the late 1800s, the last two decades of the 1800s. And, you know, it seemed, I loved in the biography, you really draw a great picture of the sort of social fabric of the time. You know, there was, and seeing Vida against that background, you know, and her parents were these sort of quite, yeah, they were really interesting. You know, like for me, like thinking about that time period, they definitely didn't seem to fit the sort of more conservative mould that a lot of people fitted at that time. So she had a very fertile sort of background in terms of growing up in an activist sort of family, didn't she?
She certainly did. And it's a period that's from, she was born in 1869. So up until Federation, it's a time that people haven't really gone into a lot. I mean, there's quite a bit about the legend of the 90s, you know, that people have written about, the 1890s, which was an extraordinary period because there are an enormous number, it seemed. There are a lot of very vocal, very intelligent people determined that this new country that was about to be federated was going to be an example to the world.
Mm.
And I really think it's the only time in Australia's fairly short European history where people have really felt that and just felt a sense of enormous possibility. And Vida rode that tide. She really did. She was very lucky, as well as having activist parents who believed that, you know, people, they did a lot of work for poor people, and they believed that people would be able to work, you know, that they should, work was dignity, and work allowed people to achieve things. So it wasn't sort of patting people on the head and giving them money or whatever. And so she very much believed in that, but she was very lucky, as I say, in her time, because there were these movements that she was able to ride. And in fact, they took her to America in 1903 as an example of Australia where women vote. So
Yeah, that was fascinating, which I'll get onto in a minute. But one of her early goals, and it did remain her goal for a very long time, was to achieve suffrage. She lived in Victoria and was to achieve the vote for women in that state. That was sort of her initial goal, wasn't it, for women's suffrage? But her early attempts were very, well, they were unsuccessful, didn't work. So,
fascinating that.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, the fact is that what I had a bit of a problem with, not really a problem with, but I knew that the federal vote had been granted and she was able to take advantage of that in 1903 to stand for Parliament. She wasn't the only woman in that election. Three others did as well. But the point is that in Victoria, you know, the whole thing was that they were the first people to agitate for the state vote for women, and they were the last to get it. And all the other states had given women the vote by the state vote by about 1902, and Victoria took until 1908. It was solely because of the Legislative Council in Victoria, which consisted of rich landowners who really... It's an interesting thing, actually. Someone should write a book about how that happened, because it was incredibly consistent and it went on for a long time that these rich men would not allow women equality. And they kept saying things like, well, what difference will giving women the vote make? And that's not the question, as Vida pointed out. It's a badge of equal citizenship. Equal voting is a badge of equal citizenship. It would have been a demonstration that women were equal citizens. And Victoria wasn't quite ready to accept that.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I think it really highlighted for me too, prior to federation and even for quite a while after, the sort of separate nature of the states in terms of the way that they were run and the sort of intellectual thinking at the time.
Oh, yeah. In fact, states' rights, we're seeing it now, actually, with the pandemic. States' rights here, as in the US, have always been, I think they've really basically been more powerful in terms of the shaping of Australia because they've, you know, there's seven very disparate parts of the country. And really, although, you know, we all say that the federal government is the big game, actually, all of us, wherever we live, I think, in Australia, are much more influenced by state votes.
Yeah, which you sort of forget, don't you, until, you know, and then when it really hit home when I was reading this, and you're right, it is still quite prevalent.
That's right. They are.
And so Vida grew up in this really, you know, as we said, this sort of really fertile family. She had lots of connections in politics, in social, you know, justice circles. She was a member of numerous groups, and she became quite an astute orator, quite influential in those circles. And she did, as you mentioned, she did actually travel to the United States, which I imagine would have been quite a thing at the time for a woman of her age.
Enormous. Yeah, she would have been, gosh, how old was she? 1903, would have been about 34, 35, I think. Yes, she travelled by herself. She had lots and lots of friends who met her and people who were in the US suffrage community, and she met them all. She met Susan B. Anthony and, you know, the names that are kind of famous now, and she revered them. She also met Theodore Roosevelt, the president, and I can't remember which president he was, I think it was number 24 or something, but anyway, And he received her regally. But what I found really amusing was the fact that she was not awfully impressed. I mean, you know, president's a president. And she was, and there's a lovely story that she kept a diary, a very straight-faced diary. And she came away from her meeting with Theodore Roosevelt, and one of his colleagues said, "Well, what did you think about Teddy?" And she said, I have the stars and stripes. I'm going to put it around his photograph. And if he doesn't do something that I approve of, I'm going to turn it to the wall." And he said, "Why don't you do that?" And I just thought, Bidey, you're so Australian. I mean, honestly. That is such a lovely piss take in an Australian way. I thought that was really funny.
She didn't mind sort of saying what she thought, did she? She was very, even though she wasn't highly extroverted, she was quite confident and quite vocal in, you know, expressing her beliefs and trying to talk people around to her way of thinking.
Mm. She still believed. It's very interesting that actually, because she came of it, it was a time when people believed, all evidence, I might say, to the contrary, that people vote having weighed up, you know, party allegiances and what their own beliefs were and decided on the basis of rationality that this was how they would vote. And she was very, very rational in her arguments, and they were good arguments. But, of course, we have seen so often since that people do not vote that way for that reason. That it's much more an emotional issue for people voting, or it's to do with, oh, I like him, I don't like her, or whatever. Interestingly enough, at the time, the press was fairly emotional about her. They didn't really go into her arguments and dissect them rationally. They would talk about such things as how charming she was, how pretty she was, what her clothes were like. And it is rather depressing to look at that and see that it still operates, that people are still looking at women in terms of their clothes, look at Julie Bishop's red shoes or jackets or whatever. And that has still, that's still the case. So it's been very interesting to look at that.
Yeah, and to compare it to what's happening now, and in many ways, so many similarities.
And she believed that women needed to have the vote so that they could be, you know, this was the way that women were powerful, that they would be able to use their vote. And she actually put a hand up for Parliament. I don't think she expected to win the first time. I really don't. But it was a way of educating women. She made a very big point of that, of showing women that this is what they could do, and this is how things could be different, and that men really didn't have a clue about issues that affected women. Women did, and it was up to women to tell men about that.
So, and it was interesting that, you know, you spoke in the biography, there's mention of, you know, different rallies and things she spoke at, and there would be, you know, both women and men at the rallies. On the surface, there seemed to be a lot of support for her from women. Then when it came to the crunch, a lot of those women didn't actually support her.
It was ever thus, I think, actually. Mm. She knew that she'd have to get support from, that just because she was a woman, she wasn't going to get support from women necessarily. I'll be very interested to see what happens to Kamala Harris when, you know, during the election, because, you know, there are all these, there's been all this, oh, she's wonderful, oh, she's fantastic. But she was clear, and she was nailed, you know, she was dialing right back on the assertiveness, you see, because women don't like other women who are assertive. A large proportion don't, I think. They were the ones who criticised Bida and thought that she had no business getting into a man's arena and trying to, you know, influence it on a basis of equality. You know, it's just the way it was, the way the women felt.
And there are other parallels you draw. You know, you mentioned the clothing and they're commenting on the hair and all that sort of thing, which, of course, we know from Julia Gillard's experience and so many women parliamentarians and women in public life. What other sort of similarities could you see between Vida's experience and, say, someone like Julia Gillard, particularly given that you've written, you know, Julia's biography?
Basically, I'd always come back to something that Gillard said herself when she was discussing this book of hers about women and leadership, the one she's recently published. She said, she'd been on record as saying, that any woman who decides to go into public life had better pretty much develop a thick skin, because they're going to get all kinds of garbage thrown at them. And that was true in Vida's case, although it was expressed more politely, although the feeling was the same, that was in Gillard's case. I mean, look, the equivalent of the Ditch the Witch and Bob Brown's Bitch placards Gillard had to handle was the fact that she was terrified, Vida was terrified, that her opponents would release rats or mice onto the platform where she was speaking. You know,
it's horrendous to even have to worry about that.
Just imagine long skirts. Oh, no, it doesn't bear thinking.
Yeah, no.
and when she was standing on a pacifist ticket during World War One, I think the bravest thing she did, in all the brave things she did, I think that was the most courageous. Standing on a pacifist ticket during World War One, saying that the slaughter on the Western Front, when everybody was saying, you know, we need to support Britain and all that stuff, people set fire to platforms that she and her colleagues were speaking on. Punch-ups were going on all over the place. There was one time where return soldiers were bad for this, where one return soldier said, you know, get out of the way, mate, we'll get her. You know, she needed a fair amount of physical courage, which Gillard hasn't quite had to cope with. Women haven't, but they've had to develop courage in other ways. Mm. And, of course, is when she's the way she handled ridicule. And I was thinking, when she first stood for Parliament in 1903 and didn't get in, she travelled around Victoria and did the equivalent of a PowerPoint presentation showing audiences the cartoons and things she had to put up with and laughing at them. It's exactly what Sarah Hanson-Young did a few years ago when she was being trolled very badly, and she read out the comments that the trolls were making and burst into laughter. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah. And, of course, it has as you say, things haven't changed. You know, whether it's women in lots of areas of public life who are outspoken, you know, especially now with social media, are finding, you know, themselves the victim of so much just disgraceful trolling. It's just horrendous, and so much more than men in the same situation are experiencing.
And the successful ones don't, and Vida I would put in this category, successful women just keep on going. They don't say, you're being really, really mean to me. You know, they just say, you know, suck it up, keep going.
Yeah, sort of accept it as part of the deal, isn't it, I guess, unfortunately, in some ways. Yeah. So, as you say, Vida was very much anti-conscription during World War One. She didn't actually achieve the election that she wanted to get. That was had been a big goal for her. But she, as you said earlier, she had a finger in many pies, didn't she? And she was quite a religious woman in a way, and part of the Christian Science movement.
That's something that has never been really written about in terms of Vida, and I wanted to tackle it because I think people's religious affiliations, if they're devout in any way, are not only an extremely important part of their lives and they need to be treated with respect, but they inform the way they think about all sorts of things and, you know, their place in the world and everybody's place, so on and so forth. Vida, Christian Science has always been glossed over with Vida because people are a bit wary of it. They think it's mad. They think it's one of those kind of nutty religions and so on. But I wanted to spend some time on it because I think it was some of its precepts and some of the way Christian Science believers deal with things actually do resonate with Vida. And I didn't speak to people who were Christian scientists or had been brought up partly as Christian Scientists, to find out exactly what it was that attracted Bida and her family to Christian Science. And I think it's fairly obvious. First of all, it's a religion founded by a woman, Mary Baker Eddy, and there was no kind of male Father, Son and Holy Ghost hierarchy, right? So that was very attractive. And secondly, there was no hierarchy of any kind in the Christian Science Church. I mean, of course, there were leaders and there were people who became practitioners and people who were just members of the congregation. I mean, that's obvious. But it was, it is and has been a faith, a religion that believes in equality as a total given, and that we're all equal in the sight of God. And it's very, a lot of it sort of has resonances with some of the, you could say, hippie beliefs, and I don't mean that pejoratively at all, beliefs in a world soul, in Gaia, in all that.
Yeah.
Resonances, there really are. So I could see why she, I really could see why she decided after five goes at getting into Parliament and not succeeding and losing her deposit the fifth time in 1917, well, you know, during the war, I could see why she decided, you know what, no. So she became a Christian Science practitioner, which meant she was pretty senior in the church.
Okay.
She devoted herself to pastoral care, really. Yeah,
which was consistent with everything she'd done previously, wasn't it, as you say? She was very much into social justice and had that great sense of compassion. How do you think she would have, like, sort of looking back perhaps at the end of her life on, you know, the things she tried to achieve and maybe hadn't exactly got there, how do you think she would have felt about that?
I don't know. I think she did congratulate. She was still alive when First Women did get into Parliament, I mean, 1943, and she wrote them very nice letters of congratulation, and she was very pleased that at last this had happened. During the 30s, the 20s and 30s, she was still around. I mean, and she actually said things that were kind of amusingly reminiscent of 1970s feminists. We were the radical generation. You lot don't know what radical means. We've done this for you, you know, and so on. And I think this is exactly what always happens with any movement like that.
Yeah.
So I think she thought she was a bit impatient that, you know, women, I mean, for heaven's sake, they'd been through depression and a world war, for heaven's sake. But still, she did feel, I think she was rather disappointed in the fact that women hadn't embraced the opportunities that, that being given the vote them to have. But also, she also did believe that righteousness alone exalteth a nation, which is very big on. So if you think correctly, if you think righteously, all will be given unto you. And there you go. That's the Christian Science, or any religion, really.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So she's a bit disappointed, but sort of thought, oh, well, yeah.
Well, she certainly paved the way for what did happen, didn't she?
She did. Yeah,
and she was instrumental.
Yeah, and she wasn't in good health in the last few years.
What do you think she'd make of progress, perhaps, that we have or haven't made today in terms of feminism and women's role in society?
She would have been delighted about Gillard, particularly since Julia was a Victorian. I think she would have had mixed feelings about the seat of Goldstein, named after her, in Geelong. Yeah, it's sort of west of Melbourne, which has always been held by a conservative man.
And the bloke, that's an irony.
Yeah, isn't it? And the bloke who is the member now, I think, would be somebody whom Gillard would have, at least Biden would have had very, very little time for in ideological terms. But so I think she would have been very pleased at at the younger generation. I think she would have cheered Greta Thunberg and Malala on, like, I believe. And it's really good that those two in particular have been galvanising younger women to the extent that they have about such important issues. and just being completely fearless and just going straight ahead and not. She would have really liked that. And she would have been pleased about things like contraception and things, but she would have been disturbed that there is still poverty, there's still such a lot of poverty, mental illness, and there are still social problems. And the fact also that, as she knew at the time and has continued, that men really run formal politics. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
Really. How about the actual research that you had to do, Jacqueline? So there's a huge amount of information in the book, and just looking at, you know, your sort of footnotes and all your references at the back of the biography, it's obviously been a huge amount of work for you in pulling all this together. As a biographer, a historian, I guess, and a writer, how do you navigate that amount of material and sort of narrow it down to the pieces that are useful for you and for your purpose?
I was very lucky. With this one, there was already a biography of Ida Goldstein, which by Jeanette Bomford. It was published in 1992. And it gave the outlines of her life. So I had a template. I had something to work from. I know, what happened when. What it didn't give and what I was interested in finding were the connections between, you know, those facts and how they affected Vida in particular. And that's fine. So I had that to start with. That was
right.
Also, I had a researcher. This is really interesting. And I thought, oh, I'll have to go to London, because all her papers were in the women's library at the London
School. Oh, okay.
There were papers. There are papers, of course, about her in the major libraries, you know, La Trobe, Mitchell, Batty a little bit, and also the National Library. They've got, you know, and I went and did all that, you know, and saw that. But the ones in London were interesting, because I thought, you know what it's like when you go somewhere where you're not familiar with it. It takes you about a week to work out how things work, and then you've got to work out, you know, and I thought, no. And I was very lucky. I knew somebody over there who was a researcher, and I paid him to go to the library, and what he did was he photographed every page of everything in her thing, sent it to me via Dropbox. This book really could not have been written without the aid of the internet.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
The other thing, Trove, which is, anyone who's done any historical work at all knows Trove, you know, National Library of Australia's digitised newspaper file. It is an enormous resource. It is, lose your way in it for days, actually.
Yeah, but I haven't used it, but I've heard it's a big rabbit hole.
Oh, it's a total rabbit hole. It's a complete rabbit hole. And half the time you find yourself looking at, you know, the life of lighthouse keepers in Western Victoria or something when you're looking for something completely different. But where they were, where newspapers were very interesting in that period particularly, was that there were so many of them, and local newspapers picked up the metropolitan. It wasn't the sort of metropolitan newspapers and the rest the way it is here. The local newspapers were huge, because that's all there was. There was no radio, no television, no nothing.
Right, yeah, of course, yeah.
Got very, very full accounts all across Australia of things that people felt mattered. So that meant that Vida's, particularly Vida's appearances and her talks in halls all around Victoria, were very well covered all over the country. So you had a pretty good chance of finding, you know, the Robe Examiner in South Australia had a copy of her first, because it was important. And they also reported speeches very fully. So that was good. That was one thing. The other thing that was interesting was the language. The language of those debates and owed a lot more to the Bible and Shakespeare than we're used to now. People had a kind of a, you know, people who read newspapers anyway, had a fairly good knowledge of biblical phrases and Shakespearean phrases. And that I found really interesting, you know, that they just don't have now. It was a kind of a lingua franca, a kind of a Freemasonry of language that doesn't seem to exist anymore. Television and media, other media has fractured that, of course. So
yeah,
it's really interesting. So yeah, that was one of the researching it was fun. It really was. Yeah.
And then, so how do you actually then go about sort of saying, okay, getting to the point where you think, right, I've done all my research, I've got all the information, and actually distilling that down into, you know, what becomes that final text?
You do a lot of preliminary work.
Yeah.
A lot of work, you write everything down, everything you've got you write down, you have something that's enormous, unwieldy and boring as anything, and you think, so you edit and you end it and you think, how did this, actually the question you always have to ask in biography really, and I think a lot of people forget this, is how did this affect the person I'm writing about? Mm. How was this an important factor in her life? Was it? If it wasn't, if it was, I mean, there's a bit of indulgence in this. I mean, I did go on a bit about what people read in the 1890s, because I thought that was interesting from a background point of view. But it's so easy to get yourself lost in that stuff, and you know, and the read and the energy leaches out of what you're writing. And I really do think that it's got to have energy. The energy has to come from subject, and that has to come through what you're writing about, the subject.
Mm. Yeah, and your attitude to it. So do you think that biography's changed in that sense? You know, I think it used to be a thing with biography that, you know, as we were saying before, they were sort of quite dry, quite factual. There wasn't really any room for your own personal interpretation or your own, you know, injecting anything of yourself into it as the writer, which seems to have changed, as you say, in maybe the last 30 years or so. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. And I think it's the way it's done that is important. And that takes a bit of getting into. I think the way it's done, I mean, if you've got the sort of stuff that I find really annoying and I can't be bothered with is I went to the library, I opened the book and I found her there. And, I don't want to know about you, what you had for breakfast. I don't care. I want to know about the person you're writing about. So that kind of, that style of, bringing yourself in directly like that,
yeah,
is, you feel like saying, it's not about you, darling, you know.
Yeah.
And that probably shows that I'm an old-fashioned kind of biographer, really, because it's true. It's I don't want to know about your feeling unless you can make them work in terms of the character. I mean, I found that there were parallels, there always are parallels between, you know, my life and Vida's life, but they weren't interesting as things about Vida's life. I mean, she was travelling. How did she get her washing done? I mean, it's...
Yeah, you talk about that, actually. It was really interesting, yeah.
It really bothered me. It really did. But yeah. I think the kinds of questions that you ask of the subject, that's how you put yourself in it.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. It's how you do it. It's, but, you know, me. I mean, you're always there, obviously. I mean,
yeah, but it's in terms of how much. Yeah. And how did you feel when you got to the end? You know, like when I know, you know, writing fiction that I sort of, when I get to that final proofread and that, you know, final sending it off for publication or whatever, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend, and you sort of get that sense of, you know, that you miss them. Did you feel like that about Vida?
I actually did. You know, the big test for me, it's interesting, this is the fourth sort of large biography I've done. I always dream about, there's a stage where I dream about the subjects, and there's nothing sort of particularly noteworthy about, I mean, they might walk past in the background, but they're there. I mean, happened again, and that was all good. But
what stage of the process do you dream about them usually?
I can vary. When you're usually pretty well faring, when you've done a couple of years' work maybe, or maybe 18 months, at the stage where you can't stop because you've got to keep going. I did also feel that, you know, Vida was kind of there and around. And what was nice for me too is that I got to read it as an audio book.
Oh, great.
It's an audio book. So the nice thing was I knew where the jokes were and I could pretend to be Vida making speeches on the hustings. So, yeah, I just, I did feel, I don't feel proprietorial towards her exactly. Mm. I know this is something that a lot of particularly academic writers do. You know, I've written about her and she's mine.
Yeah,
I didn't like that about any of my subjects because I sort of thought, well, no, that they're themselves. I'm writing about them. I'm trying to make them as interesting and as I find them to other people and make them come alive on the page. That's the job. But making them come alive on the page doesn't mean you own them. And I do think that's true.
Yeah, well, you certainly made Vida come alive for me. I found it fascinating. And are you working on another biography or are there plans for another one coming up?
I've been kind of sorting out a couple of ideas and I'm kind of mulling around and that sort of stuff, but nothing as yet. And I'm quite happy for that to be so, because I think that what happens with that is that there's a stage when you think, let's go with this. And I haven't got to that with anything yet. But it'll come. It always does.
Well, thank you so much, Jacqueline. It's been so lovely chatting to you about it. And as you say, the book, I didn't realise the book's also available on audio. So if listeners are interested, they can get it in print, audio. Is it in ebook as well?
Yep. It's all in.
Fabulous.
Which I think Vida would be very pleased about, actually.
Absolutely. Yeah. And where would you recommend people go to look for it?
Most bookshops, from what I can gather, but you can also order the audio book from, just go to the publisher, Penguin, and look it up on their website, and there's a link to the audio. That's the way you want to do it.
Yep. Great. All right. Thanks so much, Jacqueline. It's been lovely chatting. Yep. Good luck with the next biography.
Oh, thanks very much. That was great. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Rights for Women podcast. If you enjoyed listening, we would really appreciate it if you could head over to wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or review so that other people can find us too. If you want to hear more brilliant conversations with great writers, you can head to our website, www.rightsforwomen.com, where you can catch all the episodes from the Convo Couch and the Anatomy of a Novel series, as well as the book launch, a season of episodes created to help authors launch their books in isolation.
And while you are there, why don't you check out our Patreon page? Patreon is how people can support the artists making the work they love. So if you love Rights for Women and want to support us in supporting other authors, become a Patreon subscriber and get some cool little bonuses while you're at it. To everyone who is already a subscriber, we appreciate your passion for our project and thank you very much. You can always find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. Thank you for staying home and supporting our authors. This podcast episode was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.